And it's good to see you. And if you're, hey, again, if you're a guest, welcome. If I said that earlier, but if you weren't here, we're so glad that you're here. We hope you'll come back. It's wonderful to have you. I'm really honored to be able to have you. So you're welcome anytime. Hey, we're in a fourth part of a series called Christian. That's a clever title, isn't it? I know, I thought of that a lot. It took me ages to figure that one out. But I hope that we've been stirring up a little bit of thoughts for you, and we're going to be doing some more of that today. I'm going to extend this series a bit. This is part four, and if you've been offended, that hasn't been my intention, but hang on. I've got some other stuff God's put on my heart. So, or if you've been bored, you know, come back, because we're going to take it up a notch. But I want it to help us and challenge us. Somebody has asked me, this is a very frequent question that people ask pastors, is how do you think of this stuff? And it's usually stuff that I feel the Lord's convicting me of, and stuff I feel like are flaws and holes in my own life. And then I pass them along to you, and hoping that maybe some of you are in the same spot. And, you know, over the years, that's served me pretty well. Because we're going through a lot of the same things, sometimes in different stages, sometimes, you know. But as we kind of, it's kind of a first phase, as we kind of finish up this first phase, I'm going to catch you up, so some of you say, well, this is my first week. They're all available online, but I'm going to kind of help catch you up a little bit, and I'm going to take you forward. What we've been talking about is the fact that Jesus never, ever referred to his disciples as Christians. Never called them that. And that's really our something that we've been talking about all along. That came much, much later. And let me just say, for those of you who are guests, I do put a little sheet inside the bulletin if you'd like to follow along. If that's helpful for you in the learning process, feel free to utilize that. But because the truth of it is, we call ourselves Christians. I would call myself a Christian. But you can make Christian, as a worldwide view, you can make Christian mean just about anything you want. And the reason why you could do that is because it's not defined in Scripture. We can take it etymologically and say, well, Christian literally means little Christ. You know, and so they kind of put that in the dictionary. Okay, it's a person who follows Christ. But other than that, we don't have it ever defined in Scripture. And so it's only used three times in all of the Bible, of course, all of the New Testament. But we also have seen that it was a derogatory term that outsiders used to describe as the followers of Jesus, not the people who are inside. It was a term that the equivalent of which, if you're in a public school and you used certain terms, you get to go to the principal's office for free. Okay, that kind of term. All right. Some things that we don't even mention, we wouldn't even say, even in a kidding way. Jesus used different terminology, however. Jesus gave his followers a label, and they took it very, very seriously. Remember what it was? Disciple. That's right. He called them disciples. And take a look at what they did. Five years ago this month, Cindy and I were in Rome with her family and so forth. And what you find when you're in Rome, you see crosses everywhere. I mean, crosses everywhere. The crosses on buildings, you see them on top of buildings, on the side of buildings. Even the Emperor's Gate and the Slave Gate of the Roman Colosseum has crosses on it. Crosses all over the gate. Now, before you fast forward too quickly through history and say, David, I just hate to inform you something. Of course there's crosses. The Pope lives there, and I think they're supposed to do that. I want to take you through history, and just in this one scene, this one picture we captured, I think I counted seven crosses, something like that, six or seven, just on different buildings over this just strange skyline, and then there's one you can't see over kind of on the side. That's Rome. Crosses all over there. So think about this. We're going to take it to a little piece of history that's very, very interesting. If you're not a Christian or not a church person, I'll need to share you this kind of mystery of history for us to think about. If we could go back to 64, say 65 AD, that was Nero has burned down Rome. He burned the city of Rome, and he needs some scapegoats. And who does he decide to blame? Christians. Let's blame the Christians. And it blames it all. Well, and really, it wasn't called, they weren't called Christians yet. It was really this Jewish knockoff cult, that's the way they look at it, from Palestine, these Christians. So he announces that Christians burned the city of Rome, and he sends his henchmen throughout the whole city, looking for people, soldiers and everything, rounding up all these Christians and creating a thing that they called Nero's Circus. Now, it wasn't a circus like we think of circus. It was an arena where Christians were tortured, where Christians were killed. History tells us that he enjoyed taking Christians and dipping them in wax and then lighting them on fire to torch his gardens. He would impale them on poles and hang them in his palace, and he'd light them on fire. And he'd yell things like, "Truly, now you are the light of the world." And in the front of all these large crowds, these spectators, you know, he did some pretty, really gruesome things. He'd wrap them in animal skins, throw them in, and then throw them to lions or wild dogs who would, you know, tear them apart. Oftentimes, he'd crucify them. And after that was a very common way of torturous, capital punishment then. And then when the crowd got bored, because many times people hanging on crosses could last for many, many days. That's why Jesus was pierced in his side. They do that to finish it off. But when they got bored, he'd set them on fire. And so now imagine we go back to 64, 65 AD, the really gruesome scene when all this is going on, and we go outside the city of Rome, and we visit a farm, and behind the farm is a farmhouse, and behind that's a barn, and in the back of the barn huddles three Christian families, three groups that are followers of Christ, and they've all fled the city of Rome because obviously they don't want to be killed, they don't want to be tortured, and they know they've lost everything in their city. They know that they're never going back. Otherwise, that would be their life. They've lost everything, and if anyone finds out that they're Christians, there's a bounty on Christians' heads. People would be paid when they were brought to Rome and brought to Nero, and who would then, of course, persecute them. And he delighted in torture. It's not just putting them to death to eliminate them. He delighted in torturing. And so picture us. We're in the back of this barn, with these three Christian families, and we sit down in the straw, and we start talking to them, and we ask them some questions. In fact, actually, we don't just ask them a question, we inform them. And we say to them, "Do you know that the day is coming in Rome when the entire city of Rome will be adorned with crosses?" And I'm not talking about wooden crosses. And I'm not talking about even the representation of martyrdom. I'm not talking about the representation of even crucifixion in general. There's going to be crosses all over this city, and they're going to signify and remind and point to one single crucifixion. And that one single crucifixion is for the very Son of God, the Messiah that you love, that you follow, that you've given your life to. They'd say you're crazy. They'd say you're a fool. People worship Jupiter here. Jupiter's forever. Rome is certainly forever. And you say there's a time when nobody's going to worship Jupiter. You can walk into Rome and you won't see any evidence of that whatsoever. One day all of these temples that you see that are designated for this, one day these are going to be tourist attractions. Some of these are going to be churches. And they're going to have crosses, not only all over the outside, but all over the inside. In fact, the day is coming when there will be more crosses represented in this city, commemorating and reminding us of the Lord Jesus Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. His crucifixion, more than any other city in the entire world. And what do they have? All they could think of is Nero's Circus, where their brothers and sisters are being put to death. And they say, but instead of a circus, where you see that, instead, there'll be a cathedral placed there in memory of Peter. Remember Peter? You mean the Peter, denied the Lord, all that now, all that. There will be a cathedral, and it will be named after him. And all of this, realizing this path of the people following what they called at that time the way. And I know they're thinking, you don't understand. Yes, we believe Jesus is the Messiah, he's the Son of God, but you don't understand. We're a small group. We're just a little band of small, and we're just, you know, we're just trying to survive here. There's no way. And we look back and we say, they made a difference. And yet within 300 years, and historically speaking, that's a short amount of time. It's not long. There were crosses everywhere. How did that happen? How did that happen? It didn't happen because the Jesus followers decided to be Christians by label. It happened because the Jesus followers decided not to lower themselves to simply be Christians by name. It happened because the followers of Jesus embraced the teachings of Jesus at such a significant level that they took seriously that label that Jesus gave them. And over time, I mean, you can't argue this at all. Over time, this little group changed the world. So, makes me kind of think, what am I doing, you know? What are we doing, right? I'm not doing much, I don't feel like. But, and why would we settle for just being nominally Christian, which we can't even really define? When Jesus gave us some very specific instructions. So today I want us to read the message that got all this going. I want us to read that section of scripture, that teaching that everybody rallied around. It was really the beginning of the movement, I guess we could say it that way. Now, this was early in Jesus' ministry. Many of you have read these words many times before. But I want to open up maybe in a little bit different context or maybe a different application. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people have gathered, and Jesus knows, this is the moment I lay the groundwork. This is the moment I lay the foundation. This is the beginning of the movement that's going to change these men's lives, these people's lives, and the world. I'm going to introduce this group of people to the value system, a worldview, some habits, behaviors that are going to turn the world upside down. Are you ready for this revolutionary speech? It was a revolutionary speech that changed everything. It's the reason we're here today. So here is where it all began, Matthew chapter 5. Revolutionary speech. It's going to light this whole thing on fire. The movement's going. Here it is. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside. That's why it's called the Sermon on the Mount. If you ever wonder, what's a Sermon on the Mount? Sermon on the Mount, because it's on the mountain. In fact, that's exactly a picture of that area. And sat down. His disciples, that's, of course, what he called his followers. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. And here's the revolutionary, world-changing, shut-down-the-Roman-Empire speech Jesus gave. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. There you go. Then it gets even stronger. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Really? That's it. Now, you have to think of the hostility of this time, right? What's happening to Christians? What's happening? You know, blessed are those who mourn, for they'll be comforted. I mean, that's it. No, there's more. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the gentle, the humble, the considerate. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. You can just imagine someone go, pardon me, Jesus, I really hate to interrupt you. Can I ask you a question? Meek? Really? I mean, do you know what's going on in the world here, especially here in Rome? Do you know anything about Rome? Of course he does. And I'm being facetious when I'm even asking this. We haven't had our freedom in years and years and years. And do you know where meekness has gotten us? Blessed are meek, they're going to inherit the earth. We can't even control our own land. We can't even control our own nation. And you're saying meek? It goes on. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Filled with what? Filled with righteousness. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Another real quick question. Peacemakers? Lord, do you really think we're going to be able to retake our land, to retake our nation, to retake all that God has given us by being peacemakers? You know what happens when you make peace with Rome? They basically suck you in and tax you to death, and you're basically consumed by Rome. Does this make any sense at all? I mean, peacemaking? Blessed are those, verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. They can relate to that. Rejoice, what? Right? Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were with you. The crowd's response is probably like this. That's it? Maybe he'll do a miracle. This has got to turn. This speech is not going well, right? Right? Maybe he'll do something really. So here's the list. So we're thinking as they're, you know, in the crowd taking notes, right, on their parchments. So Jesus, let me get this right. I'm going to review this. So we're poor, sad, meek, righteous, merciful, pure, peaceful, persecuted, insulted people waiting for a reward in heaven. Where do I sign up, right? Is that who we are? And you think, is this going somewhere? And I'm saying some of this tongue-in-cheek. You guys are following me on this. But maybe Jesus smiled at this point as he said this because he knew the future. He knew what was going to happen. And 300 years later, the message of Jesus is everywhere. Nobody's worshiping Jupiter anymore. And then Jesus backs up and he realizes, now, all of that might be confusing. Because, you know, I think I've preached sermons on taking each of these, and sometimes you go, what does that mean? And we take them one by one, and we do a whole series on them. And Jesus didn't do that. Jesus gave them, and they're sitting there scratching their heads, I'm sure, thinking, what does he mean by this? This seems so counterintuitive. This seems so opposite. Take Rome, define it, and pendulum swing. That's what Jesus is asking us to do. So what Jesus does is he backs up, and he realizes, okay, now this all seems confusing. I'm going to give them two word pictures to tell them exactly who they are and who we are as well. Yeah, you're what I just said, Jesus is saying, all of that, that's all true, but let me put it in practical terms. His next phrase was this: you are the salt of the earth. That's who you are. You are the salt of the earth. Now, everyone in Jesus' day knew about salt because they had no refrigeration. So salt was vitally, vitally important. And what is salt? Well, salt, we know, and even today, people cure meat and stuff. Salt is a preservative. It preserves things. So since they didn't have refrigeration, they had to preserve, use it as a preservative. And salt is used still, like I said, today. So what is a preservative? Here's a preservative. Here's a lesson for you. Maybe if you don't learn anything else, maybe you'll at least know what a preservative is, right? Got to learn something in church, right? It's a substance. A preservative is a substance added to food to prevent decomposition. You know, when there's no preservative, what happens? There's rotting and there's decomposition, there's smell, there's stink, due to chemical change or bacterial action. Now, in our day, today, here we are in 2013, you look on a label, and there's always some kind of long-named thing that sounds like Latin that you go, preservative, you know, okay, well, we'll eat it, you know. We're well-preserved people, I think, probably, right? But salt was crucial in this culture. And he's saying something really interesting. What Jesus was saying to his audience and what he's saying to us today, you are the preservative of the entire earth. You ever think about that? You and I, we're the salt. What's the significance of that? We just think flavor. And we do add some flavor to the earth, don't we? But he's saying, you are the preservative of the earth. Now, imagine the world he was speaking to, a world where might made right. And if you wanted to know the right thing to do, you looked at the people with the biggest army. You looked at the people with the strongest swords. Moral issues weren't really moral issues. Ethical issues weren't really ethical issues. It was who has the longest sword. that's who won. Who was the strongest? Women and children had no rights. Mercy, compassion, generosity, those were not virtues. Those were looked down upon. Those were looked at as weak. If you are compassionate, you are weak. If you are generous, you are weak. It's a world we can't imagine. Now, unless we can actually today, it's amazing, here we are, 2013, we can actually visit countries where we would see some of this worldview. Visit Somalia, visit North Korea, visit Afghanistan, visit Sudan, visit Iraq, you know, just to throw out a few, you know, those... Still, in areas of they still see that. It's not about what's right and wrong. It's about who's got the sword. And what we can't fully appreciate, though, in our Western world, as Americans, is what we certainly can't appreciate as Americans is this: is that much of what we assume as common human decency. That's just common human decency. That's just common courtesy. It's not common. It's learned. And we still reflect, even though we are listed in the United Nations as a pagan country, we used to be listed as Judeo-Christian. We are no longer listed that way in the United Nations. We are listed as a pagan country. We still in our country hold to a Judeo-Christian ethic that goes deep into our culture. And what we consider is typically how Americans are is not how Americans are, it's how Americans learn to be. We still reflect those fundamental issues that Jesus taught that eventually went all the way around the world and transformed cultures everywhere. Now, this is not an encouragement that, okay, we're just going to go make the world, you know, a better place just to be nice to each other. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, do you realize the impact? Go back to that little farm that was with the three little families thinking life's over and the cross spreading throughout the world and the value of women, the value of children. That's not an American concept. Jesus did that. Get these kids out of here. Let the little children come to me. A Samaritan woman by a well by herself out in the middle of the heat of the day, and Jesus valued her. I'll give you water. You'll never thirst again. See, that was Jesus. That was in America. But because we can't imagine, and we can't imagine in our country, we can't imagine, you know, women being treated any less than men, although in our country we've had times when that's certainly been the case. And intuitively we know that a person should not be owned by somebody else, but of course our history reflects that as well. And we know that children are precious, but why do we think children are precious? In other cultures, children aren't precious at all. Why do we think generosity and compassion and mercy, why do we think that? Why do we think that's good instead of weak? Why do we applaud mercy? Why do we stop and applaud the person who risked their life for the sake of somebody else in need? That's not necessarily human nature. That's not common human decency. Common human stuff is defend yourself, survive, whatever you've got to do. It's the reflection of a worldview that says, there is one God, and eventually we'll give account for our life to that one single God, and God loves everyone. Red and yellow, black and white, all are precious in his sight, we sang in Sunday school as a kid. See, there's that underlying belief system that came ultimately from that ancient Judaism, and where'd that come from? The teachings of Jesus. I'm saying that because we think, I'm sitting here with a small group, okay? You know, I mean, some churches out there are described as mega this. We're not mega anything. We're mega nice to each other. We're mega nice people. But you see what I'm saying? We're small. And so part of us could say, what difference could we make? We're just huddled behind the barn trying to survive. I'm just doing my day-to-day thing, just trying to get by. And we may totally underestimate the impact. That little group of Christians, they would have never thought that they could literally change the world. And here we are. And this underlying belief system, and then the first century Christian called disciples grabbed onto that and they believed it. And Jesus said, look, you have no standing, but you're the last stand. You have no political standing, no financial standing. You don't have a grip. Nobody's paying attention. But you, he said to the crowd, you know, gathered that day in Matthew 5 there, you're the last stand. And if you aren't the salt of the earth, what happens? The earth rots. If you think it's bad now, just give up. You think it's bad now? Just give up, forget it, walk away, just go with the current, and you'll see how bad things can get. It's interesting, God, how many times he addresses Christians. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, then I'll hear from heaven, forgive their sins, heal their land. He doesn't say, if all of you out there, hey, globe, He just says, us, if my people. Do you ever think about it? You're the salt of the earth. We're keeping this place from totally going to pot, see? I don't think we can fully appreciate that. Yeah, but we benefit every single day from a worldview that says men and women and children have value. That men, women, and children are somehow made in the image of God. And that's not intuitive. I mean, let's face it. We can look and we think we're pretty well developed. But human trafficking is the world's fastest growing criminal enterprise. It's estimated $32 billion a year global industry, human trafficking. $32 billion. Report, just Thursday this week, says a comprehensive study shows that there are 30 million people who are living as slaves around the world. 30 million. And what do we say? We say, because we're here in America, we're saying, how can anybody treat anybody that way? It's simple. They don't see the world the way you do. Why? Because you've been taught to see the world the way you do. And when Jesus knelt and says, I want to teach you how to pray, and he says, when you pray, say, Our Father. That was completely different. Now it's a relationship. God is no longer Jupiter or a pantheon of gods. You know, now he's our Father. He's our Abba Father. He's our Dad. You know? I mean, somehow through Jesus, we learn that God actually loves us. And if he loves us, he loves me. And if he loves me, he loves you. And if he loves all of us, he loves them out there too. And suddenly we all have worth and we have value, and we better be careful how we treat each other. So when Jesus gathered his disciples, that's why he said, by this, everybody's going to know you're my disciple. How? The way you treat each other. The way you love each other. How you care for each other. And Jesus, this is, and you know, what isn't it great? Remember we talked about this? This is a new concept. This is totally different. And if you allow it to take hold of you, you are the salt of the earth. That preserves. And he said, as we go on, not only that, okay, you're the salt of the earth. And then he said, you are the light of the world. To which we say, I don't want to be the light. I just want to be a Christian and go to heaven when I die. You know? I mean, kind of just, that's fine, but leave me alone. I mean, I prayed a magical prayer, and so I've got it, and, you know, I've got my ticket to heaven, and I'm all good, and I just want to go back and raise my family and go to heaven when I die. And Jesus is there going, I'm not quite sure who taught you that, but you are the salt of the earth. If you call yourself a Jesus follower, he's not giving this as an option. He's not saying, okay, David, now that you've accepted me, let me show you some other stuff you could do. If you'd like, you could be the salt of the earth. And if you really feel stirred and motivated, you could be the light of the world. Jesus told his disciples, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And I'm being a little facetious, but it's kind of like you hear that and you go, wait. I just want to get by. I just want to survive. You know, do you know what's so strange about this? When we read this, now we going back historically, the world was very, very small to this group. You know, they didn't have, I mean, the world seems smaller and smaller to us now, and we can talk to people all over the world, we can travel all over the world. But during this time, history tells us, people didn't travel much more than a 15-mile radius around where they lived. One of the things that kind of amazed me when Cindy and I visited New York with Stephanie's, you know, class and so forth, we went to Washington, D.C., went to New York, you'd ask people about other parts of New York, and because they walk so much, there were parts of New York that they'd, I don't know, I've never really been up there much. And you live here, but you don't know about this, you know, and it was really quite fun. Well, in this culture, that's the same thing. You walked for a reason. You didn't go on vacation and say, hey, come on, kids, pack it up, let's go for a walk. You didn't do that. So, I mean, 15 miles was really the radius. And so Jesus is saying, you're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. They didn't even know about North and South America. You know, what's amazing is there were continents they didn't even know about that have churches on them today. Isn't that kind of wild to think about that? But Jesus, you're the light of the world, and you don't even know, you know, you don't even know everything. He says, a town or city built on a hill. Now, let me just pause for just a second, because we read that in the English, you know, built on a hill. In English, the Bible has the word, you know, the English Bible has the word built, but the Greek word really is the word placed. Some set translations say set, but it's placed because it's intentional, you know, intentionally placed. A town placed on a hill cannot be hidden. Now, in that part of the world, it's kind of flat. Some of you, if you've been there, I mean, it's hilly, it's got some hills, but it's pretty flat. Very few trees, mostly shrubs, and they built towns, and they built towns on hills, and oftentimes would cut them out of limestone. So they were really easy to see for miles and miles. And the sun reflects off of them, and at night they'd light their oil lamps, and you could see it for a long, long way away. And Jesus said, just as a city or a town on a hill cannot be hidden, that's what you are. I want you to think about that. So you're not only a preservative, what are you? You're also, you're like a strategically placed city. You're a strategically placed city. That's why you're the light of the world. You've been strategically placed, to which you say, David, no, I am not. I'm not strategically anything. I'm not strategically placed here. I was transferred here. And I didn't really want to come, and then I got here and I lost my job. You talk about strategy. Anyway, I'm stuck here. I'm not strategically placed. I'm like a misfit trying to get back home. And Jesus says, No. She says, it may seem random to you, but you are a strategically placed light. You go, no, I'm not. I was dating this guy, and he says, let's move west. And so we move here, and then he dumps me for somebody else at work. And so here I am, and now I'm a long way from home, and I got this little pity job I really hate. And all I'm trying to do is just save up enough money so I can move back to where I really am supposed to be, you know. No, Jesus, you know, you're strategically placed. You go, no, I'm not. I wanted to get into a college. I didn't get into college A. I didn't get into college B. I got into college C, and I hate it. And I'm just trying to really get enough classes, get enough courses, so maybe college A or B will take me. So I'm not strategically placed. I'm stuck here, and I don't even like where I'm stuck here, and I don't even like the people I have to live with. And Jesus says, if you're my follower, you are a light, and you are strategically placed where you are. He said this, neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the room. In the same way, and he's talking about in the same way as a city placed on a hill, in the same way as a light placed on a stand, he says, let your light shine before others. And then here's how we read the next part, really. Here's how we read this. We really read it like this, that they may see your church attendance and say, wow, he's a really good Christian. Right? We don't say it out loud like that, but we, you know what I mean? We kind of feel like that, you know. I go to church, I'm going to heaven, and, you know, leave me alone. I don't want to be a light or salt. I just want to be a Christian. That's how we read this. And listen to what Jesus said to this group of people who never really went much anywhere and didn't really have anything. He says, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. And that is so powerful. He's saying, I want you to live your life in such a way that when people see your good works, they don't go, you know, he's a really nice guy. Aren't those nice people? He said, that's not what I want you to do. I want you to live in such a way that people go, are you kidding me? I mean, who does that? Who's that generous? Who's that sacrificial? Who cares like that, you know? Who goes beyond just saying, hey, if you need anything, call me, and actually helps me? They take kids in. They'll do anything, you know? They bail you out of things. They've got your back. You work for one of these guys? I worked for one of these guys. You walk in, and I'd really blown it, and he should have fired me. And he said, hey, you know I'm a Christian, and I believe in second chances. And so I'm going to keep you on and give you a second chance. And he should have fired me. He said, what's with these people? See? That's what Jesus wanted us to do. He wanted us to live in such a way that the world's going, I don't get them. I mean, it's really cool, but I don't get them. They're really kind. They're really generous. But, I mean, I wouldn't do that. But there's something different. Jesus said, I want your deeds to be so extraordinary that people begin to connect the dots and go, are these people just crazy? Are they just, you know, overly generous? Is there some kind of personality disorder? What's with them? And they start connecting the dots, and they start realizing, wait a minute, there's something relating to what they're doing to this Jesus they talk about. And they may not talk about it a lot, but they really, I can tell it's important to them. And he says, I want them to connect the dots from your lifestyle to your Father in heaven. I want you to shine so bright that outsiders, you know, outshine everybody else, not to make an impression, but to make an impact. You know, the people go, what's with you? And when you can, you connect the dots for them so they can begin to give credit, not to you for your good deeds, but your Father in heaven. Hey, listen, some of you are great at this. Some of you are great at this. Some of you, you're just happy that you're going to heaven when you die. and hopefully, you know, you're just glad, hey, you're a Christian. And Jesus, I never called you just to put on a label and call yourself Christian. I'm telling you, you are salt. You are light. Now, again, it's one of those tags, even more so than disciple, when people say, oh, you know, do you believe anything? You know, what are you? And you say, I'm salt and light. They may go, you know, really think you've lost it. But the truth is, this is a label Jesus did give us. You are salt and you are light. In the first century, those Christians, those followers of Jesus, they got after this. I mean, they went down to the river. They took children that were being sacrificed into the river to the gods. And they grab them. They take them. They'd save their lives. They were being discarded. These kids were being abandoned. They were sacrifices. They weren't children. They were to appease a god. And so when they were thrown in the river, the Christians would go in the river. They'd snag up these kids and they would save them, and lives were saved. They took them to their homes. I mean, even though they already had children and probably having enough children, when plagues broke out, everybody would flee. In fact, history tells us about pagan priests. You know, of course, you know, a plague breaks out. What are you going to do? You're going to say, well, whoever our religious leader is, we need to go to them and have them offer prayers or sacrifices or whatever. And these pagan priests, hey, they would hear about a plague. They'd see it, you know, a breakout on somebody's skin. They go, Mabel, pack the bags. We're out of here. And they would take off. And there all these people were struck with plagues, and they would be stuck there by themselves. And the pagan priests would look at that outbreak, and they were out of there. What was so different about Christians? The same thing that's true about some of you at work. When everybody kind of turns your back, when people kind of just say, hey, you know what, good luck with that. Here's what Christians do. When everybody else leaves, Christians stay. And they help people. They nurse these people. They barely knew. They nursed them through this difficulty. And what happened to these people? People lost their lives. I mean, these were fatal plagues. And you say, well, yeah, wait a minute. If these Christians are helping people during a plague, couldn't they possibly get it? Yeah, and they died helping people. And that's something else they noticed. What is with these people? They don't seem afraid to die. And frankly, I mean, you know, who wants to die? Nobody's really excited about dying. But these people weren't afraid. They knew something. It's like people would say, they know something I don't know, and everybody's going to die. We all know that. The statistics are pretty much out there. And they don't seem afraid. Why is it so different? Something so universal. They're not afraid to die. They live their lives in such a way that pagan, Roman, Greek community began to connect the dots. They're going, this Jesus thing. They're not afraid to die. They stay when we're suffering. They're light and they're salt. That's what it is. These good deeds weren't about just them doing their own thing. It was about them living and showing love, the kind of love, you know, that Jesus told him to. In a matter of just a few hundred years, the world turned upside down. And not because of good preaching, not because of good teaching, but because of powerful living. Men and women who took seriously the admonition to be salt and to be light. So, my admonition for us is simply, bottom line, let's not settle. Let's not just settle in being just Christian, okay? Let's be salt and light. Let's be salt and light. And we're going to talk about it just as we close this. Every once in a while, you have to speak up, and you know you'll be in situations, whether it's at school, whether it's at work, or whatever. Every now and then, you'll have to speak up and say, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, I think that might, even personally, something, you know, I think that's going to hurt your life. And I'm caring about you enough, you know, that I want to tell you that. I don't think that's, every once in a while, you have to take somebody to coffee and say, look, I want to throw something out to you because I care, you know. You have to be a preserver. You have to be a light. And that lifestyle sometimes points the way. Now, I always want us to consider how this is going to work out in our lives, right? Because we go to work, we got to go to school, we live in our families, we're at home. And so let me turn it around, because the way to truly understand the significance of this is to think about your story. So we got students, we got people working, we got moms, dads, grandparents. Okay, we've got all of this here. So how do we relate this to our story? The only reason you're a Christian or a Christ follower or disciple, I've kind of wrecked that word for us, haven't I? It's okay to call yourself a Christian. Don't worry, we'll get through this series, and then we can go back to calling ourselves Christians. But I hope you see the essence of it. I hope it'll mean something different. So wherever it is, here's the deal. If you're a Christian, you're a follower of Christ, here's what I know. You're a follower of Jesus. Probably. I know I am. Because somebody was salt and light to me. Somebody was salt and light to our family. They may not have even known they were. Really. And maybe they didn't even feel like that they were, you know, strategically placed. And if you had told them that, they probably would have thought, you know, you're crazy. I'm a city on a hill at the bank. They didn't think that. I'm a city on the hill at Lowe's or at Home Depot. They may not have even been thinking that. I'm a city on a hill at the office, you know. They may not have been thinking that, but they were. They weren't thinking it, but they certainly were. They were just trying to be what they thought would be, and you noticed. And we're trying to be a city on a hill in the neighborhood. But you think that about that fact that hey, they just happened to buy the house. I mean, they just happened to buy the house. It was just one of those things. You know, the house came up for sale, and nobody, you know, offered. It was just kind of one of those weird things, you know. So, but God says, no. You were strategically placed there. It's like, you know, oh no, the Christians have moved in. They're going to wreck the party. And you decided to just love them and to be a great neighbor. And all of a sudden, they're asking you, after time and after watching you, they ask you, wow, this is real to you, isn't it? This is a real deal to you. This isn't just like a rote deal, isn't it? And you know what happens? Many of you would look back and you would point to somebody. It may have been somebody in the army. It may have been somebody at your church. Maybe somebody in your neighborhood, whatever. And you'd point back and you'd say, you know what? They were providentially placed there. I feel like God had a divine appointment and he put them there. And it just, I'm a believer now because God put them there. And you know what what we have a tendency to go is like, got to go to work again. Here I am, stuck in this neighborhood, stuck in this town, stuck in this where. You know what I mean? Strategically placed, seriously? I mean, Lord, no offense, but I just feel like I'm trying to survive. And God says, no, you never know. Go be salt. Go be light. And you'll never know, perhaps, until heaven, how God did that, how God worked. God answered prayer, you know. So you see those as providential relationships. God brought those neighbors, that boss, that friend, that individual, just the right time. So, students, you're the salt of your school. And you're saying, salt of my school? I'm a freshman. I can barely find my locker. Are you kidding me? How am I going to be salt? I'm just trying to juggle my schedule. You're strategically placed, okay? It's your office. You know, at home, in your neighborhood, we are salt. And two things we've already said, though, is true of salt. And here's what we do. We persevere, and we preserve. Salt preserves. See, salt preserves. And secondly, you know what light does? Why is light significant? Because light shows the way. It shows the way. Salt works even when you can't see it working. And light works even when you don't know it's working. Salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. And you say, well, where I work, we can't really talk about religious things. You know, it's a policy and so forth. And we don't, so I don't think that I can be salt in life. No. Salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. If you're in an office, no matter where you are, middle management, lower management, wherever you are, you're a receptionist, you own the company, whatever. If you're a follower of Jesus, Jesus would look at you and say, you're the salt of that environment. You're the light of that world that you're in. Let your good deeds shine in such a way that people can begin to connect the dots between your extraordinary deeds, what they're going to maybe think at first is just you being nice, to realizing this is more than nice. This is like over the top. This is like caring. And they're going to see, you're a follower of me. And when everybody else says it's okay, and you're saying, hey, I don't think this is okay, sure, it's going to sting. Salt sometimes stings. When everybody says, well, that's just the way we do it in our industry, and that's just the way our business goes, but it rubs against your Jesus follower ethics, and then you have to just decide you're not going to go that way. And yeah, they may ostracize you. They may make fun of you. You may accidentally make them feel guilty. That's okay. Salt stings sometimes. Lights, you know, if you're shining your high beams on a road where it's all dark, guess what? What's wrong with that idiot? Okay, you'll get some of that. You shine brightly enough, and they're going to, in a dark world, go, what's with him? Okay? Jesus said, we're the light. But you have no idea who is going to look back on that interaction and say, you know what? There was this guy in my office. There was this gal in my office. And I found out they were Christian. And this is how they behave. This is how they manage things. I never forgot that. And I knew in my heart I wanted to be like that. I never told him that because I didn't want him to, like, force me to go to church or something. But because maybe it was just I was too proud. But I never told him because it was going to just be too disruptive. I never told him, and I never forgot. And you've got people like that. Wherever you are, Jesus said, be salt. Wherever you are, Jesus said, be light. You are salt. You are light. Salt and light. Salt always preserves, and light always points the way forward. Now, here's what you don't know and what I don't know. You and I have no idea who is around us that is on the verge of breaking through simply because of our salt and our light. You may never know the end of the story, like I said, until we're in heaven, and we may never know how our interaction impacted them. But here's what you can be assured of. Again, salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. So let's not settle for Christian. Let's be salt. Let's be light. Okay? Let's bow.